You and I back together again for a midweek Wednesday, February 9th, 2022 edition of Connecticut Today. We heard parts of Governor Ned Lamont's 2022 State of the State address and got some analysis on the whole thing from Greenwich GOP State Senator Ryan Fazio. Also, Wall Street Journal reporter Eric Schwartzel, who's covering the film industry for the Journal, joined us to talk about his brand new book, Red Carpet, Hollywood China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy.
Omicron was a curveball, but our hospitals stayed above water. Our vaccine lessened the severity of the virus. And I've asked you, the legislature, to weigh in on just the last few executive orders, which allow us to move quickly in the event of another COVID variant. And before you do, I think you know I've been working with our neighboring governors, and I believe it's time to end the statewide school mask mandate and allow each and every school board to decide what is best for their schools. From a public health perspective, you've earned this freedom. I know that we can do it safely. Our Department of Public Health, Manisha Jitani, she'll provide clear guidance along the way. We know how to live safely in this post-pandemic world. The referee is not going to throw the all-clear sign and say we're zero infections, but we know how to live in this post-COVID world, even though COVID will never be zero. Public safety is right up there with public health as a lead responsibility. And Connecticut remains one of the safest states in the country, although certain crimes are up. Many of the car thefts and other street crimes are a symptom of a population reeling after 2 years of COVID hell. Free summer learning camps and clinics and in-person schools relieve some of the stress for a lot of our kids. But for others, long COVID is playing out in a national trend of fentanyl poisoning, as well as vandalism in our schools. Hate crimes have been spray painted on synagogue walls. Suicide and domestic abuse have brought violence right into the home. And here across the country, gun sales and shootings are on the rise. Last May, I was at a ball field in Bridgeport to show support for some young baseball players who the day before were forced to flop belly down on the ground when shots rang out nearby. Thankfully, no one was injured. Two teams of kids laying belly down on a field, not sure whether it was safe to get up. I was there in the community the next day that chose to stood up and rally for those kids. They understood what the sound of gunfire while playing an innocent game of baseball could do to the psyche of these kids, especially if it went unanswered. We have more damn guns on the street today than ever before in our state. Get these illegal guns out of our communities and let our kids be kids. Let our kids be kids. Thank you. All right, so our budget calls on Commissioner James Rivella, Commissioner of Public Safety, to create a special illegal gun unit working with our neighboring state to track down these big gun traffickers. Look, I've said it before and I'll say it again. You can't be tough on crime if you're weak on guns. Don't worry, I also want more cops on the beat. Our 10 largest cities and towns alone are training and hiring nearly 400 new cops over the next 2 years, and we've made sure they have the budget to do it. And as I've done with our state police over the last 3 years, we are adding more female recruits and creating more diverse police force, just like our community police have got to do. More diverse, more women, community policing that is by, for, and above about the communities. That's what community policing is about. Look, those preventative measures only work if the judicial branch continues to speed up criminal cases, so people who pose a risk to the community and themselves are kept off the streets. Please vote early on the outstanding new judges that I'm nominating and support the funding that I have proposed for new prosecutors and new public defenders. Okay. As important as it is responding to crime is preventing the violence before it happens. That's another reason we're investing hundreds of millions of dollars in education, workforce development, and mental health. And mental health. And mental health. And mental health. It's not just summer programs and keeping our schools open during the non-school hours. I mean, many of our schools have also added counselors, since many of these kids just need a shoulder to lean on. Look, and we gave many of our high schools the opportunity to vote on how they would spend $20,000 in Rescue Act funding. What the Enfield High School, and when I asked how they would invest that money, the student council said their top priority was more confidential counseling. These are high school students. I was thinking Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And they said more confidential counseling. Think about that for a moment. Our budget doubles down on community solutions. Project Longevity in New Haven, Bridgeport, and Hartford have received more funding to reduce violent crime in Waterbury. The Police Athletic League is letting more police and kids get to know one another before. These programs give kids a friend, they give them some hope, they give them some purpose, and that's the best anti-crime strategy in the world. At the end of the day, what matters most in all this is trust. Trust in your law enforcement, trust in your courts, trust in your government. I will hold anyone who breaches that trust, starting in my administration. I'm going to hold them accountable. I have zero tolerance for any ethical malfeasance. We hold ourselves to the highest standards. If you see something, say something. And if you don't get the response you deserve, give me a call. Over the last 3 years, we've been faced with unprecedented challenges. The type of challenges where people turn to government for leadership, for answers, for guidance. They did so because their lives and the lives of their loved ones depended on it, in ways not seen since perhaps World Wars or the Great Depression. I believe Connecticut stepped up, meeting its moment in history when it mattered most. And we did that together. We did that together. I'm immensely proud of our state agencies who, many months there, we're working 24/7 at the Emergency Operations Center, Sundays, Saturdays, late, early, and they were there responding to the pandemic. I'm also particularly proud of our first responders, doctors, nurses, teachers, nonprofits, child care providers, all the essential workers who, despite the risk of their own health and safety, put their communities ahead of themselves. Retired teachers and nurses coming out of retirement to pitch in and cover for their sick colleagues. That, my friend, is the Connecticut difference, standing up and making a difference every day. And your vote makes a difference. 4 years ago, hundreds of voters in New Haven waited in hours in the pouring rain, clutching a soaked ballot in order to cast their vote. Well, since then, we've had a couple of elections where voters turned out in force because they could vote absentee and they could vote safely. So following the lead of Secretary of State Denise Merrill, let's make it easier for absentee balloting. Let's make that a reality, not just during a pandemic. Make it easier for people to vote. I like people having a stake in the election. I like them voting. I like them believing in the outcome. I like them knowing that their vote makes a difference. All right, I'm getting there. 3 years ago, I said I wouldn't let the state be defined by a constant fiscal crisis. And while there is much work to do, over the past 3 years, we've turned that fiscal crisis into the Connecticut comeback. Budget deficits have become record breaking surpluses. Our budget reserve fund is now overflowing, and we are paying down pensions, and we can borrow more money at less cost, and we could return millions of dollars back to the middle class for the first time in a generation. And just as I said, I didn't want our state to be defined by a chronic fiscal crisis. We can't let it be defined by a COVID crisis either. And despite the intense headwinds of a global pandemic, we've made significant progress with more jobs created, more families moving into our state, and more opportunity for all. That's the Connecticut difference, and we're going to keep making a difference every day. May God bless each and every one of you in the great state of Connecticut.
Well, the governor delivered his State of the State address today, also presented the next budget framework, which spends a considerable amount of money. I think it's about $24 billion. Reaction from the other side of the aisle. Let's start to get that now with a Greenwich Republican State Senator Ryan Fazio, who I'm assuming was in attendance today. Hey, Ryan, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great, Ryan, to do this for us. We appreciate it. Well, give us your thoughts, the good, the bad, the half and half in the speech and the proposals as the caucuses are now seeing them. What do you think?
I was generally unhappy with the economic proposals that the governor made today. He started by taking credit for better fiscal stewardship of the state, in particular, the rainy day fund and fewer tax increases in the past 2 years than we had seen in the state for the prior 10 years. But then he introduced fiscal proposals that raise spending substantially in a state that has the second highest taxes in the country and some of the highest debt and unfunded liability burdens in the country as well. So good fiscal stewardship in a state like that can never be to raise spending by more than you need. And yet, the fiscal proposals today, in of course in an election year, were for hundreds of millions of more spending beyond what we've already budgeted. I don't think that's responsible. I think that it's going to hurt our economy, hurt the middle class years from now, and result in more tax increases in the future. And we all know that we don't need that. There is more than enough revenue that the middle class sends to the state government every year in this state that can be spent wisely. And so the state government should do that.
Ryan, one thing that has kind of bothered me and what we heard today and some of the framework, and I know the governor is pitching $330 million and something like that in tax relief, and I understand, you know, he wants to rework the automobile taxes and wants to rework the, you know, the property taxes. But, you know, Ryan, not everybody owns property, so they're not going to benefit from the property tax levels being adjusted. You know, not everybody owns a car that's responsible for, you know, property taxes there. So, Ryan, I've been a little disappointed that the governor doesn't do something that's broad-based, Ryan, like maybe shave a little bit off the income tax or maybe a hair off the gasoline tax or sales tax. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are exactly along the lines of yours, that tax relief in the state should be fair and broad-based and help everybody from the working poor to the middle class and beyond. So I co-signed the Republican caucus, Senate Republican caucus plan to lower the sales tax over the next 2 years because inflation is one of the biggest problems facing the average family in our state and across our country. And so actually addressing that problem directly in an immediate manner, in a broad-based manner, is both fair and a direct response to the problem that we face. In the long run, I agree. We need income tax relief because income tax is the tax that that reduces economic growth more than most other types of taxes. It makes it harder to raise a family here. It penalizes work. It penalizes job creation and investment in our community. So in the long run, we need to reduce that. It's pretty high here compared to other states. But the taxes that the governor has chosen to propose to temporarily relieve in the fiscal situation we're currently in are very narrow. They're kind of good talking points, but they don't actually help the vast majority of residents. I mean, the reduction in the car tax, the maximum car property tax is to, I think, 29 mils, which doesn't affect residents of, A, it doesn't affect residents who don't own a car, as you point out. It also doesn't affect residents in towns that are generally fiscally responsible and don't have enormously high property tax burdens. It wouldn't alleviate the tax burden on anyone in my district, because the three towns that I represent are all below 29 mils in property tax. So I don't understand how that can be considered fair. And I think there's a much better way.
All right, Ryan, hang on. I want to come back after traffic and weather together, and we'll get your thoughts on what the governor said regarding guns and crime as well. Ryan Fazio, the guest, first, though, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue with Republican State Senator Ryan Fazio getting his analysis, seeing what he thought among all the folks sitting there listening to Governor Ned Lamont's state of the state address. Ryan, what did you think of the criminal justice proposals addressing mental health, addressing counseling, which I don't think people can argue against? There is the rhetoric about guns. And Ryan, I was a little disappointed, I don't know whether you were or not, that all of what we hear from the governor and his administration so far on this, I mean, I don't know, do we address the scourge of criminality now that is in our cities? Are we going after, you know, criminals who actually commit crime here, or are we going after law-abiding gun owners again?
Boy, I thought I was through the looking glass when I heard that proposal. I think it was 6 months ago that the governor said that Connecticut has the toughest gun laws in the country. He doesn't see a reason to significantly alter the gun laws anymore. But all of a sudden, and at the same time, of course, they were saying that there isn't a crime problem in Connecticut, that maybe there was a slight uptick. But now he's changed his tune on both counts. I'm old enough to remember that a year and a half ago, the Democratic state government significantly altered the policing laws in this country on the premise that there was something fundamentally unjust about our policing here in Connecticut. And every single Republican in the state Senate voted against it and spoke out, saying that this would endanger all of our citizens' safety, especially our most vulnerable citizens in our most vulnerable neighborhoods. And exactly that came to pass in the months subsequent to the police law passing and a lot of the provisions going into law. Criminals were galvanized and the general public was made less safe. Police have been demoralized and put on their back foot. Valuable proactive policing tactics have been banned or made more difficult. For instance, consent searches, which are absolutely protective of civil liberties, but also a vital proactive policing tool that takes hundreds of illegal guns off the street in Connecticut, was banned by the police bill. I do not understand any good reason for that, but it was banned, and it takes hundreds of illegal guns off the street in Connecticut, and it takes hard drugs, illegal drugs off the street in Connecticut, and yet it was banned. But I don't understand now that we need new gun laws, but we're not enforcing the legitimate existing gun laws, which are proven to take illegal guns off the street out of the hands of criminals. What's going on here? This is a total distraction. The Senate Republicans and the House Republicans have proposed legislation that would significantly alter the police bill and all of its errors in order to keep people safe, to give police the tools to keep us safe. That's the logical way forward. We're all old enough to remember this. We can't be gaslit.
And Ryan, what you mean, just so people understand this, a consent search, meaning if a police officer pulls you and I, Ryan, over anyone else, and they have suspicion legal enough to think there's funny business going on, they can then ask us, do I have your consent to search your vehicle? Is that what we're talking about here?
Correct. And very, very often people say yes. And so, you know, then the police officer, unless they have reasonable cause, is not going to search you. Otherwise, if they say no, then they're not going to search you. But if you say yes, they have the right to search you because you said yes. And very often that's a way that police find illegal guns or illegal drugs and are able to take them off the street. But that practice was banned. And I have police officers in my district and beyond who've who volunteered the fact that this is a problem. This is how we take contraband off the streets. But they're no longer allowed to because of the police bill that the Democrats passed in 2020.
Mind-numbing. Ryan, thanks. Ryan Fazio, Greenwich Republican State Senate member. Ryan, we appreciate the time. We'll talk to you in the coming weeks. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Ryan. Well, there you go. I get you. Look, and again, what happened with George Floyd was horrible. Everyone can agree on that. You know, the guy, Derek Chauvin, if I'm king, Derek Chauvin is facing the death penalty. His underlings there, the three guys that he was supposedly training or whatever, you know, they're on trial now for civil rights violations. Okay. But because of what happened in Minneapolis, was it necessary to change policing laws in Connecticut? I don't understand that. Did we have police officers in Connecticut killing suspects, putting their knees on them? I don't. And you heard it there from Ryan, and he says he's hearing it from police officers in his district. We've heard it from people who call here. I've had state police on. I've had, you know, legislators who either are active police members or were, saying, you know, basic tools to get criminals off the streets. I'm not saying this is what they're saying, kids. You know, basic tools are now illegal in Connecticut. Why? Because of something that happened in Minneapolis? Again, explain this to me. I don't get it. I don't get it. Honestly. I mean, if it was there overt police brutality here in Connecticut? Yeah, I get it. I understand that things happen. But do you trash an entire system? Do you trash things that in some ways help stem criminality? Because you had a few out-of-control officers who are bad apples? Isn't that the true definition of throwing the baby out with the bathwater or not? Again, what am I missing here? And you're also hearing about, the fact that cops can't stop someone because of a burned-out taillight or a burned-out license plate light or windows being tinted too much. Why not? I've been stopped for taillights or headlights, I think, three times in my 60 years on the earth here. And the officer came up, he looked at me, he took my my license, registration, insurance card, and he came back and he had his flashlight on him. He looked in my back seat, looked in the front, he goes, okay, you got to fix that. Now, you could say, well, Paul, he used it as an excuse to pull you over. Well, yeah, but you know what? Why not? Again, if you're not a criminal, what is everyone worried about? If you're not a criminal, if you don't have drugs in the car, if you don't have a gun in the car, what is everyone worried about? It's so bad here in Connecticut, we've got to strip police officers of these tools? I'm sorry, I don't get it. By the way, and again, I had guests on, if you remember, post George Floyd in the weeks and months after that. I remember distinctly I had a gentleman on whose specialty was training police departments in de-escalation. And I remember him telling me, oh, the Minneapolis department is it's well known being a corrupt department. He said he wasn't at all surprised what happened in Minneapolis. Okay. So that affects what we do here in Connecticut. Again, I don't get it. And we continue right here in a midweek Wednesday edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. a lot of people watching or maybe not watching. If the TV numbers are any indication, the Winter Olympics in China, a lot of criticism, though, aimed at the Chinese government, their treatment of Uyghurs, and overall suppression of free thought and ideas. But one thing the Chinese did learn, perhaps from Americans, is the power of entertainment industries and movies in particular. Our next guest has a brand new book out on just that. He has covered the film industry for the Wall Street Journal since 2013. Before that, an award-winning reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Eric Schwartzel joins us. Eric's book, Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. Eric, thanks for joining us. How are you, sir?
Hi, I'm great. I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Paul.
Well, thank you, Eric. Important book. Boy, they say timing is everything, Eric, in life. And this is a perfect time, I think, for people to read this book, to hear what you have to say. I've noticed a couple of articles that have been around about this book in the media. It's getting very good reviews, Eric, on a topic that a lot of people, Eric, are not familiar with, how the Chinese have kind of gleaned experience and lessons from watching the American film industry, and they do that now to push their worldview. How are they doing that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And they are pushing a worldview, I think, a couple of ways. One is through economic leverage, and that is by sort of controlling access to the Chinese box office. Every movie that gets into China from overseas has to pass censorship from Chinese Communist Party officials. So that means that by now, Hollywood studios have absorbed lessons they have to keep in mind about what will fly and what won't in movies if they want to play in Chinese theaters. And then the other arm of the campaign you're referencing here is, I think, happening more specifically in China itself, which is China's efforts to build its own film industry and ship its own movies around the world with their own values, much as Hollywood did for the past 100 years.
You trace this back, Eric, to, I think, just before 2010 in Los Angeles at film classes. Talk a little about that and film marketing industry people.
Yeah, this was a fascinating story I found while reporting the book. It was around 2008 when a group of Chinese officials and executives came over and met with Hollywood executives and officials at UCLA. And it was in a literal classroom where the Chinese officials sat in the seats and listened to a series of lectures from the executive on how Hollywood came to be. How did it come to be as powerful as it was? How was a movie put together? You know, really kind of the nuts and bolts of the American entertainment industry. And it was this fascinating scene for me to explore, because here we had an actual example of China literally learning from the best in the world at how to tell effective stories. And for the past decade and a half, that's what they've been trying to do.
Eric Schwartzel is the guest. Eric, hang on. We'll be back with you. More about the book, Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. The name of the book, Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. Eric Schwartzel is the guest, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's covered the film industry for the Journal since 2013. So, Eric, you have the big American, largely entertainment companies, the big movie giants. They see the size of this Chinese market, hundreds of millions of people, dollars dancing in front of their heads. Is there any recrimination at all, Eric? Did you find any of it in the research for this book? Is there anybody in Hollywood that says, yeah, we're making money, but if we're playing by the Chinese communist rules, we have a little dirt on our hands? Yes or no?
I think so. I mean, it depends on where the executive is sitting. I think executives who are in the job are quicker to defend the decision, and they have a good case. They say, look, this is a market reality, and you know, I can either make as much money for my shareholders as possible or not. And also, I think they would also say, you know, is it really fair to deprive 1.4 billion Chinese people of, you know, good entertainment because we're mad at their government? You know, I think that might be what they say. But I think especially as we've seen China punish Hollywood more recently over and over again by not letting certain movies in, there's a sense among some executives who are wearier than others, who think to themselves, man, I really feel like we got played here.
What about the actors, Eric, the producers, the directors? I mean, artists are all supposed to be about free expression, right? Any recrimination, any anger that movies that they work on have to get cut and edited a certain way. Is there any big pushback on that? Is there anger that the movie that's okay for the American market or the European market might not necessarily be okay for the Chinese market?
It has been very, very few and far between to see critics within Hollywood speak out. I mean, there have been a couple examples here and there of directors saying, you know, we should really take a closer look at this. And you're right that it does go against the values that this industry has always stood for. But to be honest, it really is a few and far between situation. Right now, I think we're seeing a lot more criticism come from pockets of certain consumers. I think some consumers who don't like to see Hollywood bowing to China have spoken up. And certainly in Washington, this has been a bipartisan issue that's gained more and more support. I mean, I always say this is one of the few, Chinese censorship is one of the few things that Ted Cruz and AOC can agree on is a bad thing. And I think as tensions between the two countries rise and as more and more of a focus is put on China's human rights abuses, I think that will be the case even more frequently.
Do you think, Eric Schwartzel, that the Chinese people kind of get it? Do they know they're seeing some version of an American movie that, okay, the government sanitized this, or, yeah, okay, every movie we see has us winning. We know that doesn't happen. Are the Chinese entertainment consumers smarter than their government makes them out to be?
I think that they are absolutely smarter than the government makes it out to be. And I think, frankly, they're smarter than a lot of Americans make them out to be. I think Chinese moviegoers are far savvier than I think they often get credit. And they know when they're being pandered to by Hollywood or by their government. So if the government releases a movie that is just sort of blatant propaganda, the audiences know that. If Hollywood makes a movie that is just sort of blatant pandering to the Chinese market, they know that too.
In the few seconds we have left, Eric Schwartzel, I kind of find this ironic is that, you know, you go back a few decades and there was this Red Scare among many mainstream actors, actresses, playwrights, and it's almost kind of come full circle, hasn't it? You know, people 10, 20, 30 years ago might read this book now if they were here and say, see, I told you so. The entertainment business is kowtowing to the commies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It does feel like a bit of a sequel on our hands, right?
The name of the book, Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. Eric Schwartzel, thank you for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.